Laudator Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and a very warm welcome to today's broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick and I'll be with you for the next half hour. Coming up in a few moments. Would Saint Dominic have proclaimed the gospel the internet way? From Brighton to the Bridgertines, Mother Ricarda, Joanna Bogle tells the story. And a sound picture of the humanitarian relief efforts of Pius XII. Well, thanks so much for joining me once again. Pope Benedict began the week by speaking to the participants of the Pontifical Council for Social Communications, who were holding their plenary assembly this week in the Vatican from February 28th to March the 3rd. One of the speakers at this assembly, which focused on the theme language and communication, was a tall and communicative Dominican. But before I let you hear his voice, I'd like to share with you the story. It was Christmas Eve of 1948, when in the immediate aftermath of the Second World War, a French Dominican by the name of Raymond Pichard realised the potential of an all-new media to proclaim the gospel, television. Bringing in real time into the homes of the French people, on the flickering light of their black and white brand new TV screens, the Holy Mass celebrated that night in the Cathedral of Notre Dame, in Paris, of course. Breaking new ground, this first ever live broadcast set the seed for a far more complex project. One which evolved in 1949 when Father Pichard obtained an hour and a half broadcasting slot on a national channel. And one which, less than 10 years later, it was 1954, took the name of Le Jour du Seigneur, the Day of the Lord. Over 60 years on, this project is still at the cutting edge of change. As my communicative Dominican friar, Eric Salobir, explained to me this week at the Vatican, in the course of the plenary of the Pontifical Council for Social Communications. Let's listen.
The broadcasting of the Mass is to help people to pray. It's specifically dedicated to people who cannot attend physically to the Mass. For them, it's very, very important. More widely, the question is which image we can show from the Church. And so we try to show different pictures of the Church, different communities and so on. And we try to deal with these topics with the help of people of the Church who can explain things. And so the public can discover that the Church is, most of the time, better than they can imagine.
Better than they can imagine. Obviously, it's Dominican run, but are you all Dominicans or are there lay people involved?
No, we are a team of 60 people, only 5 Dominicans, the other are lay people, because we try to have more skilled and qualified people than only specifically religious one. So it's very important to have people, for example, who have an experience, who worked on other TV shows, non-Catholic, non-religious, because they come with their own experience and it's good for us.
Tell me, do you have a particularly popular show?
This is popular on France Télévisions, and we try to extend this popularity on other channels. For example, we co-produce shows or documentaries for other channels in order to reach more people, to touch more people. And we are specifically involved in the broadcasting on the internet. And this is my job in the team.
The internet reaches out to more people across the world. It's not so limited to France, is it?
The idea is to reach more people than the Catholic one. On the internet, someone can find a video at random, or I think this is the providence, but they will think it's at random, and they will see one of our videos and discover something they will not discover on the TV.
You met with the Pope on Monday. Is there anything that the Pope said that was new to you or particularly significant?
I think what's very significant is the interest the Holy Father has to these new medias. And I think there are several very interesting things he has well understood. And I think this is something new at the beginning.
This afternoon you're going to speak to a group of communicators. What are you going to tell them?
What I'll try to say this afternoon is that new medias use new languages. And so we have to discover, it will be a bit technical, but we have to discover which are these new languages to try to speak these languages. Something more short, more humoristic, a bit different from what we do on other medias the church uses very frequently.
Do you have any particular project that you want to talk about? I know that you're going to focus a lot on the beatification of John Paul II.
Yeah, we will launch a web TV, Le Jour du Seigneur web TV, lejourduseigneur.com, on the internet in place of our current website, a few days before the beatification of John Paul II. And it will be the beginning, the start of a new project to be more present on the internet and to broadcast more videos and specifically to answer more directly to the question of people. Everyone will be able to ask a question directly on the website and a priest will answer in video in short and dynamic answers.
So it's interactive.
Yeah, we will try to speak really the language of young people.
Why did you call it Le Jour du Seigneur, which in English means the Day of the Lord?
It's broadcasting on Sunday. This is the day when the Lord will come. And this is the show where people can meet the Lord, even if they don't move from their house, and they can attempt to the Mass and have a contact with the Eucharist and the prayer.
You belong to the Order of Preachers, the Dominicans are the Order of Preachers. Do you think that you're following in the footsteps of St. Dominic? Or do you think that it's become part of the charism of the order? And is this a new way to preach?
The charism of our order is very, very wide. And this allows us to do very, very different things. And I think that preaching on TV is really what Saint Dominic would have done if it would have a TV at this time. I think really he was a little bit disturbing in the way he was preaching because he was trying new things. And so we try new things too because we are sons of our father Saint Dominic.
What do you find most rewarding in your job?
What I prefer is the interactive dimension level of the job on the internet. Because on TV, you speak to people and they cannot answer. So you don't know if people like or don't like your TV show. On the internet, people answer, people comment, people click on like on our Facebook profile. And so we have an interaction with people, with real people. On the internet, it's not virtual. It's really real people, and we can discuss with these people. And this is really interesting.
The content changes because of the format you're using, no? It's more emotional, isn't it?
It's more emotional, really. There's more humor. But specifically, it's more religious. Because what people want on a TV show, it's what the church thinks about, for example, something in the society. But what they are looking for on the internet are things about the sacraments, about prayer, about the life of the church. So it's specifically more religious, more Christian. We are really in the center of the faith.
And warm thanks there to Dominican Friar Eric Salobir for sharing with us this information. Moving on in the broadcast, I'd like you to meet Joanna Bogle, a well-known English Catholic author, whom I met by chance one morning here at the radio. Attempting to make polite conversation, I discovered she's currently writing a book all about a Brigittine sister who, in the dramatic days of World War II, took part in the humanitarian relief efforts the Pope of the time, Pius XII, had requested from religious houses. This is what she told me.
Her name is Mother Ricarda Hambra. At least, that was her name as a nun in religion. She was a Brigittine sister here in Rome. But actually, she ended up having three names. She was born Catherine Hambra, rather a well-known family, on the Isle of Wight. Before she was born, they'd owned a castle on the Isle of Wight, Steep Hill Castle, now demolished. Her family lost all their money, and she was baptised a Catholic and given a new name, Madeline. So she becomes Madeline Hambra. And by then her parents were in the 1880s, were living in what I suspect was sort of shabby poverty in Hove on the south coast of England. And then she became a nun and took the name Richard after one of the English martyrs, Ricarda in Italian. It's prettier that way.
Who was the English martyr, Richard?
Richard Reynolds, who was one of our famous English martyrs. This tells us that she really would have had, as so many converts do, a very strong feeling about, you know, returning England to the Catholic faith. And she became a Brigittine nun here in Rome with Mother Elizabeth, the Swedish lady who revived the Brigittines. I think there would have been a great sense of romance about doing that, you know, reviving a medieval order. And here was this Swedish woman, Mother Elizabeth, who'd done that, Mother Elizabeth Hesselblad. And imagine being an English girl and hearing about that and deciding, I will take the name of an English martyr and go and join the Brigittines in Rome with this other convert from Lutheran. And so she did, and she arrived here in Rome before the First World War. But that's actually only the beginning of the story, because the most exciting thing is what she did in World War II.
Of course, during World War II, Pope Pius XII had asked all the religious houses to actually help out with the Jews in Rome. And many of the Jews in Rome were hiding in religious houses.
Yes, and that's what happened with the Brigittines. Mother Elizabeth Hesselblad was well known in Rome. She was an unusual figure, this Swedish lady founding the Brigittines. And they had this house, still have it, a beautiful place on the Piazza Farnese. And it was a guest house. All sorts of people had been to stay there. And some Jewish people who knew Mother Elizabeth, because she was well known in Rome and they knew her socially or whatever, went there and asked for help.
Of course, the nuns were risking their lives.
They would have been shot. There was no if or but about that. And they hid these Jewish people, 12 or 13 of them, an extended family. And, of course, there were no ration cards or anything for Jewish people who were in hiding, so nobody had much food. And the nuns would share the little food they had with these Jewish people at nothing. And it's an heroic story. Because they'd been running boarding house, you know, a place, well, still run, where you can go and stay, pilgrims, visitors to Rome, they were very vulnerable. I mean, Germans would stay there and everything. It wasn't like a totally enclosed community. I think there may have been some sense of protection. I'm not sure how realistic it was, but perhaps a little extra protection because Mother Elizabeth Hesselblad was Swedish and they were neutral. And Mother Ricarda was absolutely in charge of these Jewish people. I think they didn't tell the younger nuns, you know, the less everybody knew, the better. And she was British, so she would have had absolute confidence, I think, that the British will win the war and it will be all right. But I mean, you know, you couldn't be sure. And they were very, very brave. And they saved all those lives. And although it would be far better if not one single Jewish person in Italy had died in the Holocaust, every life saved, and there were an awful lot saved. Well, that's something. And it means an awful lot if you're that person.
You're having trouble actually really finding out who Sister Ricarda was, no, in a sense.
Yes, actually it was quite funny because I'm a talkative English woman and I turn up with my notebook and I want information. How did they get the food? Did they, I don't know, forge ration cards? How did they eat? When people came to the door, you know, routine inquiries in war, who have you got in the house? Can I see their passports? How did they cope? You know, I want the story. And they were very sweet at the convent. Some of them had known Mother Ricarda, particularly, you know, after the war, of course. She didn't die until the middle 1960s. So these sweet nuns remembered her as their novice mistress and all that kind of stuff. So they had probably never asked her questions. They had probably never pumped her. You know, it was considered normal. Well, during the war, of course, you do what you can. It's war. These people might die. We must help. But you don't go around telling everybody who comes to the convent, hello, I'm Mother Ricarda. I'm your boss. Now, let me tell you how we did things in the war. I think you would think, well, that was what I did, you know. And so I think she took some of the information to her grave, and so did the other nuns around at the time.
But was it just Jews that she harboured?
There were a number of other people, and the strange thing was that they had other guests, you know, in the house, including Germans, particularly when the Germans occupied Rome. And that seems extraordinary, but it's, of course, a big, rambling house. And it was all very discreet. You know, it would just be don't ask, don't tell, and only afterwards, the family that they hid, the main Jewish family they hid, come back every year to say thank you. To me, Mother Ricarda was also a very strong-minded woman who had a very strong conviction of her call.
And a big thank you there to Joanna Bogle, wishing her luck on her book, focusing on Mother Ricarda. Finally, to end the broadcast, I'd like to pick up on Joanna's story, offering you some background on that dramatic era. That's why in a few moments I'll be sharing with you a programme focusing precisely on the humanitarian relief efforts of Pope Pius XII. Let's begin then by listening to one of his appeals for peace.
Di migliaia di persone, le quali senza veruna colpa propria, talora solo per ragioni di nazionalità o di stirpe, sono destinate.
Hundreds of thousands of persons, through no fault of their own, sometimes only for reasons of nationality or race, are destined to death or to a gradual extinction.
I cui orrori noi già fin dall'inizio più volte denunziamo.
It was Christmas 1942, and war had been raging for over 3 years. Pius XII had consistently, persistently denounced the horrors of the war and of the Holocaust. His appeals for peace fell on deaf ears. His appeals for humanitarian relief did not.
The humanitarian work of Pius XII during the tragedy of World War II was extraordinary. Because the human dimensions of the greatest war of history are staggering. Millions and millions of dead. And many more millions were innocent victims of the struggle of war, violence, bombing, deportations, starvation, and all that. And from the very first day, Pius XII knew that from his experience in World War I.
Jesuit historian Father Robert Graham, foremost expert on the Vatican and World War II, helped research and write 4 volumes of correspondence focusing on the Vatican's humanitarian activity during those tragic years of war.
A non-political activity, for which now they criticize him for not being political enough. He was a non-political voice, an angel of relief for millions and millions and millions of people.
That opinion was echoed in an editorial in the New York Times of Christmas 1942.
In these circumstances, no one would expect the Pope to speak as a political leader, or a war leader, or in any other role than in that of a preacher ordained to stand above the battle, tied impartially, as he says, to all people, and willing to collaborate in any new order which will bring a just peace.
We cannot judge him in the context of today. We have to consider what the situation was at that particular time. A few of the sisters told me how frightened they were when the Nazi soldiers or the fascist soldiers would knock on the door and ask them if they had any Jews hidden.
Sister Margherita Marchione spent several years collecting testimonies from some of the thousands of Italians whose lives were saved thanks to Pius XII's strategy of action.
In 3 of our convents right here in the city of Rome.
This was actually something Pope Pius XII asked religious to do in those war days, wasn't
yes,
it?
Yes, he did. He spread the word by word of mouth because it was impossible for him to put in the newspapers what would have happened. The Nazis and the fascists would have gone directly to all the convents and monasteries. He recommended to all the superiors of the convents and monasteries and different parishes to open the doors and to help save the Jewish refugees.
Israel Zolli, chief rabbi of Rome during those years, confirmed this in his autobiography.
The Holy Father sent by hand a letter to the bishops, instructing them to lift the enclosure from the convents and monasteries so that they could become refuges for the Jews. I know of one convent where the sisters slept in the basement, giving up their beds to Jewish refugees. In the face of this charity, the fate of so many of the persecuted is especially tragic.
So impressed was Zolli with Pius XII's zeal in helping the Jewish people that when war was over, he converted to Catholicism, taking the Pope's name, Eugenio. But Rabbi Zolli was not the only one to recognize the Pope's zeal in defending the Jewish people. In January 1945, an extreme fascist, Roberto Farinacci, lamented.
For a few years, Pope Pius XII has fully espoused the Jewish cause to the point of offending the sensibilities of his flock. We never imagined that our pastor, the Vicar of Christ, the head of the Church, could one day be regarded as the most influential defender of the interests of the Jewish people.
Rather than being a silent pope, then...
He was a pope of action, I would say.
He worked in silence.
He did. He had what I would call an underground railroad. And some authors have actually attributed saving the lives of 800,000 Jews and other refugees to Pope Pius XII himself, through his representatives, who were the sisters and the priests and the monks in the different areas, and actually in the Vatican itself. Pope Pius XII was able to keep hidden in the Vatican thousands of Jews, not only in the Vatican itself, but in Castel Gandolfo, at his summer estate. For all the years of the war, Pius XII did not go to his summer estate because during that period he had these people hidden. And I have a lovely photograph, Veronica, that shows in a room of Castel Gandolfo about 20 women holding their babies in their arms and feeding them and just living in the apartments of the Holy Father.
Did you ever see any of the refugees in Castel Gandolfo? Oh,
surely. Because one of my headquarters was the papal villa, and women with their children were actually to the beautiful crucifix in front of the papal apartments. You'd go and you'd find women bathing their children. The staircase leading up there, on every step, there was somebody sleeping.
Monsignor Carol Abbing worked closely with Pius XII in organising a relief network for thousands of people on the battlefronts south of Rome.
We were cut off practically from Rome. Any kind of regular communication. Pius XII was always he'd right through to the substance of something. And he might say, well, why are you telling me this? And he said, what do you plan to do? You see, which was logical. I'd actually not plan to do anything. And I said, well, I wouldn't even know how to begin. But I know these people, tens of thousands of people living in the caves, desperately making little caves themselves to get underground because they're terrified. Every day, bombardments and all. Their worldly goods are all there. Their wine is in the little wine cellars, and if they move, they lose everything, as I was able to see later. So I don't know what, but I said, I think that we should have a better picture of what it is, you see.
So you're talking about thousands of people, are you?
I'm talking about thousands of people, yes. So I said, I'd just like to see what can be done. And he said, God bless you. He said, let me know how I can help you. Without thinking of his own safety in any way, people never seem to value what happened. Were the Nazis happy about him? We say he never denounced them. It's not true. I was present every time, the New Year greetings to the diplomatic corps. And it's telling me, I used to shiver listening, and I'd look around and I'd see some of the diplomats with their drawn faces because these words are, they might bring a thunderbolt in the next day.
If the Gestapo had crossed the border between Italy and Vatican City, they would have found refugees hiding everywhere.
In November 43, by and by the house got filled with people hiding from the Nazis for various reasons. Some because they were of Jewish race or origin, some of their political or military position. Also several young fellows, for the young people who hide in order not to be drafted.
Eva Maria Jung Iglesias was one of those who found asylum inside Vatican City.
So they were sleeping in the museum inside these ancient sarcophages. At least they were safe for a moment. And we made a service day and night round the clock of two who had to watch in case the SS would arrive. Had to be aware of this possibility that the Germans would come in, but fortunately they didn't.
And it was also from the Vatican that prisoners of war could keep in touch with their families.
Calling its correspondent in Bombay. The Vatican Radio is calling its correspondent in Sydney.
The Germans, they thought it was a source of espionage, and they would have nothing to do with it. And there was no messages from the Vatican Radio to Germany, because it was prohibited to listen to the Vatican Radio. And that was a sore point with Pius XII. Well, as I said, they had a phobia, the Germans did, that this was an intelligence operation. Well, that just shows how little freedom of action the Vatican had in doing this charitable work. But it went ahead just the same. And it was a matter of great pride and consolation for the Pope to be able to demonstrate in this public way how he's concerned for the victims of war.
In England, after the war, the Illustrated London News acclaimed Pius XII as a hero. Winston Churchill's first cousin, Sir John Leslie, recalled.
I remember the Illustrated London News just after the war had a great double sheet coloured photograph of what they called Pius the Great. And it gave a resume of his life underneath. And they looked upon him as a great force for good in the war, which of course he was. And he became a hero, I'd say, the Pope, to England after the war.
And when the war was over, the Rome Jewish community hung the following notice in the city's Museum of Liberation.
The Congress of the Delegates of Italy's Jewish Communities, held in Rome for the first time after the liberation, feels profoundly the duty of directing reverent homage to your holiness and to express the profound sense of gratitude which animates all Jews for the proof of human brotherhood furnished them by the Church during the years of persecution and when their lives were placed in danger by the Nazi and fascist barbarity. Many times, priests suffered prison and concentration camps, sacrificing their own lives to assist the Jews by every means.
I hope you found this feature I put together for you interesting. That's all I have time for on today's broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick. Thanks so much for listening. Meanwhile, should you wish to check out our website, the address is www.vaticanradio.org. Bye for now. You've been listening to the English programme of Vatican Radio. Laudetur Jesus Christus.